This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. In 1949, the first geodesic dome rose on the campus of Black Mountain College just outside of Asheville. The dome was made of aluminum airplane struts, and it was so strong that photographs document architect Buckminster Fuller and his students dangling from the dome's supports. Buckminster Fuller went on to become famous for his geodesic domes, a building structure so strong it survived Hurricane Katrina. The genius of the geodesic dome and other inventions stemmed from Fuller's fundamental belief that it was now technologically possible for humans to provide for all of their needs and, in his words, render selfishness obsolete.
This is real news of our century. It is highly feasible to take care of all of humanity at a higher standard of living than anybody has ever experienced or dreamt of, to do so without having anybody profit at the expense of another, so everybody can enjoy the whole earth, and can all be done by 1985.
All right, well, we may not have met his deadlines, but the ideas of Bucky Fuller are still relevant and inspiring today to today's architects, inventors, and philosophers. We're talking about Buckminster Fuller today, his life, his ideas, and the future, if some of those ideas were to be embraced. Also talking about his time in North Carolina, and we're taking your phone calls at 877-962-9862 if you want to talk about Bucky and his life, with my guest, Lloyd Stephen Seiden, the author of the book Buckminster Fuller's Universe, His Life and Work. Lloyd Stephen Seiden, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Good to be here.
You got interested in Bucky after you went to one of his lectures in the 70s. What was it that inspired you?
Well, it actually wasn't so much that. I mean, I had the typical experience, which I've heard now from people for the last 20 years since the book came out, which is, you know, his lectures weren't lectures. They were actually thinking out loud session. He was not a great communicator. He would talk. And what happened was the same experience that, like, I've heard from a lot of people, which is, that was the most amazing experience of my life. It changed my life. I have no idea what he said.
He did talk in a way. I mean, he created his own language. He had a kind of a hyphenated stream of consciousness style that was a little hard to follow.
It was very hard to follow. In fact, I don't know anybody who's ever been able to follow it.
And yet his ideas do, as you say, inspire when you hear him or when you read what it is
right.
He has to say.
Right, and that's why I actually wrote the book that I wrote, because it's an easy entry point to Bucky. You know, and I was doing, after he passed on, I was producing events with him when he passed on, and after he passed on, people would say, well, what should I read? Because we were doing events with video and stuff, and I'd go, well, you know.
what should we know about Bucky?
Bucky? Probably, first of all, let me correct something. The first geodesic dome was built a year before the dome with the pictures of the people hanging. It was built at Black Mountain College, and it fell apart. Lasted about 10 seconds. So Bucky was a big one on making mistakes. He called them learning experiences. And that was a learning experience. He went back and said, okay, now what? You know, what can I learn from this?
Well, what did he learn? What was wrong with the first one?
Well, the first one, the materials weren't good.
Uh-huh.
And the mathematics weren't right, exactly. And he used to get in front of the room, and one of the things that he would say is, the reason I'm in front of the room and you're sitting out there is because I've made way more mistakes than you. Learning experiences. And so the most important thing for me is the 56-year experiment, which was in 1927, at the age of 32, he was basically a failure. He had lost his money, all his friends' money, because he decided that he wanted to build great buildings rather than make money. And it didn't work. And he was penniless. He'd been thrown out of Harvard twice,
mm-hmm.
not just once, but twice,
because
he was quite a party guy in those days, and he spent all his money on parties. And what happened was, he was walking along the shores of Lake Michigan, and a lot of people have heard this story, and he found himself walking, standing in a ball of white light 2 feet off the ground, and a voice spoke to him, the traditional mystical experience.
Yeah.
And the voice said, you do not belong to the universe, you belong to something. You do not belong to yourself, you belong to the universe, something bigger. You don't have the right to kill yourself, because that's what he was contemplating doing.
And he wrote a manifesto in which a kind of a pledge in which he pledged himself to the greater good,
right,
and said that he wasn't going to, you know, that one of the things he would renounce is any sense of profit or ownership over his ideas.
Yep.
Which I think is profound. One of the most profound parts of that manifesto for me is, or perhaps striking, is that he said he would never try to persuade others to persuade humanity to alter its customs or viewpoints.
This is true, and he didn't. He would actually wait for. He noticed the thing, the way we operate is something he called emergence by emergency. So when we have a problem, we look for the first solution around. And bottom line is he created solutions to problems that he saw would happen 50 to 100 years in the future. The geodesic dome is one of them. The geodesic dome is not designed to build primarily for houses and small buildings. It's designed to cover massive amounts of space, bigger than football fields, half cities, you know, and have them be heated and cooled with a minimum amount of effort.
And the underlying principle in all of this is what you just said, that minimum effort. How much can we do with how little energy and how few materials?
Right. That's the trim tab factor that he always talked about. In fact, that's what it says on his gravestone. Call me trim tab.
And this idea leads him to an even broader thought, and this is perhaps one of the most controversial and difficult for us to embrace, that there's so much energy in the world, and it's all available to us, that the fact is, and this is something he said very often, we could easily become a world of 4 billion billionaires. There were
right.
only 4 billion people in the world at the time. Now there's 5 billion.
Well, when we look at energy, that, you know, the big thing we're looking at now is energy, because gas is getting so high and all that, and Bucky predicted, you know, that this would happen. But he actually mathematically calculated way back before there were computers that if we could harness something like 0.01% of the solar energy that was hitting the planet, which is all that actually gasoline is, it's solar energy that's been gone through a huge process, that we would have enough energy to do everything for everybody. He also predicted that sometime around 1976, we would reach a point, because we were doing so much more with so much less, basically every time resources came around, we add knowledge to them, and when we add knowledge to them, we can do more with less. Because it's the same copper, and he used to talk about the copper in the satellites. It's the same copper in the satellites that's used in the cables that run under the ocean, but you need tons and tons of copper to carry phone calls under the ocean, whereas you need pounds of copper to do lots more in the satellite. So we were doing so much. He predicted that we were doing so much more with so much less that he said in 1976 we'd reach a point where there would be enough resources on the planet to take care of everybody at a higher standard of living than anyone's ever known. Now, since that time, people, you know, the food people have proved that about 1976 we reached a place where there was enough food to feed everybody. And now we're pretty much knowing that there's enough resources to do everything, but we have to make the global shift in consciousness,
the important thing. And what was the thing, and what's interesting is what Bucky says stands in the way of us becoming one of 4 billion billionaires.
Right. Well, he said the big shift is quite simple. I mean, I was listening to folks who were at the Clinton Global Initiative, and they were talking about this, and they were saying to me, oh, Bucky is probably smiling down on this because this is exactly what he said. He said we have to shift from weaponry to what he called livingry. So we have to shift our focus from trying to kill each other to supporting each other. You know, and when we do this, his world game, which he started where he was documenting all the resources on the planet, and he was doing this in the 30s and the 40s and the 50s before there were computers and before anybody ever cared, the world game actually proved that mathematically that there were enough resources to do all this if we shift. We only need like about a third to less than half of the global military budget to go to livingry. And all of a sudden, everybody is fed, clothed, housed, and everything.
And Also, Bucky thought, it's not that it was ever thus. It wasn't that we were always, as humankind, in a position to do this. It is very specifically that we have come to this point in our technological evolution that we're now prepared, in fact, to make...
Right. And the year that he predicted was 1976, or about that time. And that's when we got there with this more with lessing, as he called it, trim tab factor.
And what's a trim tab?
Trim tab, everybody thinks that the big ships and airplanes and everything, is, especially big, you know, ocean liners, are steered by the rudder. They're actually really not. At the back of the rudder, there's this very small tab, small rudder. And in order to steer the ship, you turn the wheel, which moves that rudder, which shifts the pressure on the rudder, which shifts the trim tab, which shifts the pressure on the rudder, which causes the ship to turn. So bottom line is, if you want to really make a difference, you look for the trim tab factors, where you can make the most difference with the least amount of effort. For instance, it's easier for us to be doing this radio interview and talking to how many ever thousands of people, if this is a trim tab, as opposed to me talking to the guy next door, talking to somebody else, one-on-one.
Well,
so
we
look for these. The internet is a huge trim tab.
And he was very confident that these things would take place without the kind of exhortation that he renounced. We're going to talk more about his thoughts, his optimism, some of the inventions, and also take a look at the exhibit at Black Mountain College and his impact, Buckminster Fuller's impact on the state of North Carolina. We're talking about Buckminster Fuller, his life, his universe, and his work. Just ahead, more of your calls and more conversation. Support for the State of Things comes from listeners who support North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. Buckminster Fuller was an architect, philosopher, and inventor with a profound belief in the potential of human technology. From the 1950s until his death in 1983, he shared his ideas in books and famously long lectures.
I hear a lot of people say, I don't like machinery and technology. It's making a lot of trouble. Upset all the old things. So we're going to take all the machinery away from all the countries in the world. All machinery. All the tracks and the wires and the works, I'm going to dump it all in the ocean. And you'll discover that within 6 months, 2 billion people will die of starvation, having gone through great pain. So you say, that's not a very good idea. Let's put the machinery back where it was. Then we're going to take all the politicians from all the countries around the world, and we're going to send them a trip around the sun. And you find we keep right on eating. And with the political barriers down, you'll have what the scientists have said is necessary. The scientists say very clear, you could make the world work and take care of 100% of humanity at higher standard of living than anybody had ever known, despite an increasing population, but you can't do it with the barriers any more than you can try to run the human organism with a wall between the ear and the eye and the stomach.
Buckminster Fuller's lectures left people inspired and many times mystified. We're talking today about those ideas and how they look in today's world. We're talking about Bucky Fuller himself and all of his complexities. We're joined by John Wright, who is the board chairman of Black Mountain College and Museum. We're also joined by Lloyd Stephen Seiden, who is the author of Buckminster Fuller's Universe, His Life and Work. You know, in the late 1940s, Fuller came to North Carolina to teach at Black Mountain College near Asheville. And at that time, the college was at its height. It was a magnet for avant-garde thinkers and visionaries like Fuller. Black Mountain College Museum and Arts Center currently has an exhibit about Buckminster Fuller, and we're joined now by board chairman of the Museum and Arts Center, John Wright. John, welcome.
Welcome. Thank you.
How did Buckminster Fuller end up at Black Mountain College?
Well, he was teaching in Chicago at the Institute of Design, and he was actually a last-minute replacement for another Chicago architect. And he came down in the summer of 1948 and was such a hit that summer that they invited him back to be director of the summer session in 1949.
So he was not first string. He wasn't your first choice.
No, wow. But he quickly became first string.
Yeah, I guess so. Lloyd Seiden, how is it that Bucky's reputation, I guess, wasn't good enough at the moment, huh? 1948, would that be?
Well, he was not well known. I mean, yeah. He had a lot. Once again, he was doing this thing about creating solutions for problems that he saw well into the futures, and nobody cared. Who cared about a car that would get 50 miles to the gallon? Nobody cared. And, you know, even though he built, it got 40 miles to the gallon in the 30s. Nobody cared. You know. So, And he was also doing this thing called the 56-year experiment, which I alluded to but didn't complete, which, being 56 years old at the moment, I know 56 years is a long time. And what he did in 1927 was he decided to dedicate his life to an experiment to determine what determine and document what one individual could accomplish that could not be achieved by any organization, religion, government, no matter how large or powerful. Since he had no resources, he used himself as a guinea pig. The experiment lasted 56 years, and the results are phenomenal. You know, longest listing in Who's Who in America, all kinds of books, inventions, tons of stuff that he's done that really hasn't come forward, and a way to live on the planet as a global citizen and make a difference. This whole trim tab idea, the whole idea of synergy. When he's the one who brought forward that term. If it wasn't for Bucky Fuller, we wouldn't know what it was.
And his concept was, well, explain that as he understood it.
Synergy?
Synergy.
Yeah, well, synergy is actually a term that comes from chemistry. And it really isn't what people think it is, where a whole bunch of people get together and, like, wonderful things happen, they make millions of dollars or whatever it happens to be. What it is synergy is that parts of systems when they come together, can't be determined by looking at the parts separately. So synergy is not necessarily good or bad, positive or negative. The example that I give, you get a whole bunch of really, really good, talented, wonderful, high-intentioned people together, and you send them to Washington, D.C., and they probably create less than they would have on their own. You know, so it's not necessarily a positive thing, it's just a phenomenon.
Well, what was his impact, I want to ask you, John Wright, on the college when he got there? Because in terms of the melding of minds, that does sound like real synergistic possibility.
It was a synergistic phenomenon, really, and it was happening long before Bucky came to the college in the summer of 48. He was brought a different perspective, however. I would say that most of the creative people who were at Black Mountain College had more of an aesthetic, artistic bent, and what Bucky brought was much more global kind of view that was based in science, particularly his own brand of science, and really broadened people's ideas of design, so that when he was teaching design, it was based on mathematics. And in some ways, this fit rather well with some of the other folks who were there at the college, because, of course, Joseph Albers and many others who had really founded abstract expression, later abstract expressionism, but before that sort of abstract geometric design, were at the college. But Fuller brought a whole new dimension to that.
Is there a sense that he may have thrived even better in an environment like that, where there are mostly artists, rather than a scientific or a technological environment where his ideas may have been met with some skepticism?
Yes, I think that's a good observation. And the people there were more open. There were certainly some people who were skeptical and some who refused to go to any of his lectures. So it wasn't across the board by any means, but most of the people at the college for both those summers of 48 and 49 were pretty much captivated by Bucky and fascinated by what he had to say. For example, the artist Elaine de Kooning, Willem de Kooning, later to be wife, was very excited and said that, you know, it really opened her mind. In fact, you know, the anecdote at the beginning about hearing Bucky for the first time, and my own personal experience was hearing him at a lecture at the University of Illinois in the 1960s, was the very same thing. I mean, he talked for 5 or 6 hours. I had no idea what he was talking about, but it's amazingly inspiring. And I do remember that the notion of the sort of global view that the entire world was one, the spaceship Earth idea, was the thing that really stuck with me.
Lloyd Stephen Seiden, one of the interesting things, and I think it was an element in the tape that we heard earlier, was Bucky's confidence in the individual and also his confidence in technology. I mean, it'd sort of be hard to put him in a category if he's a sort of progressive environmental green these days, because he really had great faith in technology. That was the thing that was going to transform us. The trouble was getting a particular political and economic system out of the way that had to put meters on everything.
Yeah, and he was totally trying to build things that were autonomous. The Dymaxion house was designed to be an autonomous dwelling machine that you could take anywhere. So, and the global vision that he had, I mean, when people would say, what are you? I mean, you only listed a few of the things that he actually was. He was also a poet, and, you know, he wrote books of poetry and an artist and all kinds of other things. And he used to say, I'm a comprehensivist, and that we're all born comprehensivists. We're interested in everything. And what we do is we get special, the system specializes us out of, makes us specialists. And when,
yeah.
And the specialization is what's causing a problem. The system, the people in power, that it's the old divide and conquer, and to keep conquer, keep divided. And that's what happens. He also talked a lot about, and I just heard Wayne Dyer talk on the PBS thing about, you know, people being de-genius, which is a term that he came up with. Everybody's born a genius, and then by the time we're 12 or 15, we've been de-genius.
Well, he has this quote in the book Critical Path, where he says, quotes his mother saying, darling, never mind what you think, we're trying to teach you.
Right. That's exactly, you know, and my, I have kids, and I watch them at school, and I figure that my job is to see that the system, the schools, and everybody else don't de-genius them too badly.
Did he consider himself a philosopher or a mystic in any spiritual sense?
He really didn't talk about that much, but if you look at his entire life, and especially the way he passed on, when he was actually complete when he passed on, you know, that's how the mystics work. You know, he actually basically told everybody he was going to die, and 2 weeks later he died at a place where he was in the intensive care unit of a hospital visiting his wife, who was in a coma. And if there was anywhere where he could have been saved, he was there.
Yeah.
And they found later on, they went to his desk and they found this pile of papers, and said on top was a note that if anything happens to me, please make sure that this gets published. This is the last thing I really have to say.
Well, Lloyd, I know, and what was in that document?
That turned out to be the last book that was published. It was published a few years after his passing, and I can't for the life of me remember the name. It wasn't a very popular book. Critical Path is the book you want to read if you're looking to read a Bucky book.
Yeah.
By Bucky.
Well, Lloyd, I know you have to go, and I want to thank you for being with us.
My pleasure. It's been a joy. I always love talking about Bucky.
Lloyd Steven Seiden is the author of Buckminster Fuller's Universe, His Life and His Work, the topic of our conversation today, a conversation you can join by calling 877-962-9862. John Wright is with us, board chairman of Black Mountain College Museum and Arts Center in Asheville, where there's an exhibit now that takes a look at Bucky's life and work. Bucky has certainly, John Wright, become something of a legend. Does he deserve that reputation?
Oh, I think so. I know that he's whenever the sort of roster of outstanding people of the 20th century is put together, Bucky is always up, well up there in the list. And he's certainly legendary in the history of Black Mountain College. He had a major impact at a really critical time in the college. And, you know, from my own standpoint, he's legendary. Whether he was a commercial success in, you know, all his different ventures is another matter. Before I moved down to North Carolina, I was at Dearborn, Michigan at the Henry Ford Museum, and I was in part of the process of acquiring the last remaining Dymaxion house. And we had a lot of these conversations about, you know, well, here's an invention that failed. So why would we want to have something like that in this museum, sort of the triumphs of technology? And we decided that the house was, and Bucky and all of that represented was so inspirational that and was very much a part of the history of technology that it was well worth having it there. And so it is there now at the Henry Ford Museum in Michigan.
And what have we learned from some of his failures? Have they been pursued by others in the field of technology and science and improved on?
Yeah, definitely. I know that, for example, it was when we opened the exhibit in July, it was fascinating to me that we had this kind of cross-section that you referred to earlier. We had architects at the opening, and same with visiting the exhibit. We've had artists, designers, And we've had sort of new age people who kind of wander in and talk about how wonderful it all is, and the mystery of and the magical powers of the tetrahedron, which was also Bucky's favorite shape. So we've seen that in all those ways, he really is legendary. And the exhibit, which, let me put in a plug here, we have this exhibit of artwork showing all of his major inventions, as well as some three-dimensional objects and some models of spheres and the like. And we're at 56 Broadway here in Asheville, so everybody should trek out to Asheville on a nice fall afternoon, see the leaves, but don't forget to come down to 56 Broadway Wednesday through Saturday.
How much of Bucky's inventive genius is sort of in our world today, and we may not even know it? I mean, certainly geodesic dome, we see those, and I suspect stadium architecture and the rest. But what else?
Well, I don't think it's so much the specific structures and inventions, although I can think also of the Dymaxion car, which was a complete and utter failure in the 30s. But really, as people have looked at it, it was really a very early forerunner of the sort of hybrid cars, high mileage, aerodynamic cars, the notions of streamlining, all of that was important.
Let's go to the phones now. Andrew is on the line from Raleigh. Hi, Andrew.
Hi. I used to work for a outfit called Synergetics. You were talking about synergistics. Synergetics was an architecture and engineering firm. And apparently Fuller spent a little bit of time here in Raleigh at NC State at the School of Design. And he was kind of a knucklehead, according to the story I've heard, a knucklehead about the geodesic dome idea, because he always thought that you could make a sphere, which he knew was an extremely efficient surface-to-structure enclosure, always thought you could make it out of great circles. Great circles are like the equator. And he thought you could just take all these hoops and wrap them around, but he could never make it resolve. And it was really the genius of a fellow named Duncan Stewart, who was on the faculty at NC State, and a guy named T.C. Howard and Jim Fitzgibbons, that discovered how to make the trigonometry work and take the tetrahedron, the octahedron, icosahedron, all of the platonic solids, and develop them into a geodesic dome that would actually work. So Fuller was a great marketer, though, and he was able to capture the idea and take credit for it, and he's been known for it ever since.
Well, let's get a thank you for that, Andrew. To what extent does Bucky owe his work with other people and collaboration with other people?
I would say that this happened again and again in his career. He was a great marketer, and he knew the value of talking things up. I mean, the man talked from morning to night, except for the period of time, I think, in when he went through his crisis earlier in his life, when he didn't talk at all for a year or two. But aside from that, a similar experience happened in terms of a man, important designer and artist named Kenneth Nelson, who was one of his students in Chicago and came down with him to Black Mountain College in 1949. And Snelson had developed this idea of structures that could be held together with tension rather than with compression, and really took Bucky's ideas a step further. And it's another case of Fuller, in a sense, appropriating the idea, marketing the idea, coming up with the cool name tensegrity for it. And Snelson is, I would say, you know, not happy about this. We tried to give proper credit in our exhibit to Snelson's work, and in fact, he's still doing very well as an artist. He does these tensegrity sculptures, and the big one was just opened at the new Museum of Art at Knoxville.
You've talked about the diversity of you know, the folks who come to see the exhibit. Has it been a popular exhibit? Do people today know about Bucky?
You know, it's incredible. Black Mountain College existed from 1933 to 1956, which is not very long, but an awful lot of famous people were there. Famous artists, designers, writers, you name it. But of all these people, unquestionably, Bucky Fuller is like the most well-known name, the household word of the whole group, the whole bunch.
When you talk about a guy like Bucky Fuller and a place like Black Mountain College where these ideas all take shape, what happened? Why is it that we're not pursuing Bucky's ideas more completely? And why is Black Mountain College not there, or places like it?
I think that Bucky's ideas have really sort of gone out into the environment, into some of the thinking, the notion of the spaceship Earth, the design ideas. They've changed form. They weren't the particular inventions that he came up with, but his inspiration was just massive. I was thinking too when we were talking earlier that some of his notions about how things can come together in unexpected ways and that were really important and are still extremely important, I think more important than ever. And there are a lot of people, influential people, who in a lot of different fields, particularly in design fields in particular, right, who haven't forgotten about Bucky.
Well, John Wright, I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
John Wright is board chairman of Black Mountain College Museum and Art Center in Asheville. We're talking about inventor, philosopher, mystic, and poet Buckminster Fuller today. Our conversation continues as we can come back with Jay Baldwin, the author of Bucky Works, Buckminster Fuller's Ideas for Today. We'll take more of your calls at 877-962-9862 on the state of things when our program continues. Stay with us. This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stacia. We're talking this hour about Buckminster Fuller. Think geodesic domes, concepts like synergetics, the world game, spaceship Earth. Fuller's visions about the potential of technology to improve human life continue to inspire scientists, architects, and others. We're joined by Jay Baldwin, author of Bucky Works, Buckminster Fuller's Ideas for Today. Jay, welcome to the program.
Hello.
Joining us now also is David McConville. He is the founder of Illuminati, a company in Asheville that designs immersive projection environments. David McConville, welcome.
Thanks.
Tell us of what is an immersive projection environment.
The simplest way to put it, I guess, they're mediated spaces that use projection of audio and video to surround an audience to be able to transport them to any imaginable space, where you visualize all kinds of data and information to put them inside of that space.
And one of the uses, so give us an example of how you might use this.
Well, the easiest thing to think about is a planetarium. A lot of what we do, it's kind of from that realm, mm-hmm, where people sit inside of these domes. A lot of times they're geodesic spaces. And with video projection technology and computer database visualization technology, we're able to actually look at numerous types of data to fly from the surface of the Earth out to, say, the background microwave radiation and the furthest things we can detect, and then all the way down to the molecular level and everything in between.
That gives us a good idea. One of the and this idea is drawn from Bucky's notion of the world game. Tell us how these two ideas come together.
Yeah, absolutely. A lot of what Bucky was talked a lot about was the need in learning and to understand ideas was the construction and display of models and the use of narrative story-like examples. And so Bucky had developed this idea of the world game where you could visualize different aspects of the planet, and by looking at them, by physically being able to see different aspects like population, and he would do shipping lanes and railroads and transatlantic cables and food production, that it would enable people to better understand how they can develop solutions for the world that we're in, to actively engage with the information instead of it just being some kind of dead, abstract, yeah, numerical, unrepresented entity, that they would actually be able to look at it and engage it directly. And a lot of effort is going into now. There's actually a Spaceship Earth game being developed in conjunction with the Buckminster Fuller Institute to utilize video game technology so that people can really start to positively affect and understand the world that we're in using contemporary gaming technology.
More about that in a moment, but I want to turn now to Jay Baldwin, author of Bucky Works, Buckminster Fuller's Ideas for Today. Jay, you knew Bucky personally. How did you first meet him, and what was that meeting like?
I met him when I was 18 in 1952, and I was in school at the University of Michigan, and Bucky was in Ann Arbor preparing for his first commercial dome, successful dome, which was made for the Ford Motor Company to cover their rotunda building. And I went, a friend of mine who was a graduate level student said, you have to hear this guy talk tonight. And so we went to the lecture, and it went on and on and on, as has been described.
Mm-hmm.
The 7 o'clock, I think, and by midnight he was still talking. And he said in 52 that pretty soon we'd be able to go coast to coast in 5 or 6 hours in jet planes. Everybody, the majority of people in the room, roared with laughter and left.
And this was in the early 50s.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so there was just a few of us left in the room, and Bucky said, I've got 600 slides with me. Would you like to see them?
This is midnight, right?
Yeah.
So what'd you say? Yeah. Well, let me
and,
ask.
I was not baffled. Somehow, I understood very clearly what he was talking about. And later on, we had he needed a single room, and I happened to have a single room in a Alpha Rho Chi architecture fraternity house. And so I gave him my room, and he saw a picture of the hot rod I'd built in high school, and we started talking about cars, and I insulted his car, and we got in a big argument about it.
This would be the Dymaxion car?
Yes.
Yeah.
But at the time, I didn't realize the importance of this car, but I did realize that that single back tire was not going to work very well if it blew out.
Mm.
And in those days, tires blew out very easily. And
But some of the ideas, of course, we've taken from that are the aerodynamics.
Yeah. That got me into aerodynamics,
yeah.
And I'm still working with aerodynamics. I just got done designing an RV that gets 20 miles per gallon, and it actually does in road tests.
You talk about the folks just laughing and walking out of the room when he talks about some of his ideas. One of the seems to me the foundation of his thought is this notion that we're working under a faulty assumption. It's the myth of insufficiency. We don't have enough. And he takes a look at Malthusian economics and projections and Darwinian projections and says the whole premise is that we don't have enough stuff and that the strongest will get it all and the rest of us are going to have to fight for what we get. And that's simply not true. There's plenty of energy, plenty of stuff available for all of us, and hence the quote that we could be a world of 4 billion billionaires. How was he always talking this way, and how did people perceive those ideas?
Well, he was always talking this way, as far as I knew and know him. And don't forget that in the 50s, we had just got done with a war which drew us out of the Depression, a big depression at last. And I was a child in the 30s, and I knew perfectly well what was all too well what the Depression meant. And people were thinking, you have to earn a living, you have to earn a living. And one of the things that Bucky asked me when I was 18, he said, why are you in college? And I said, well, you know, I can get a better job, make mm-hmm. a better living. And he said, my boy, you don't have to earn a living. And I said, really? What do you do instead? And he said, well, you got to think of what are we for? What are human beings for? And he said, you don't see the squirrel outside. There's a squirrel in a tree outside the window. It doesn't have to rent the tree and pay tax on the nuts. And the universe, and he never said the universe. Once in a while accidentally, but the universe would be a sculpture. And one of his big points is that everything is in motion in universe. And he said, universe takes care of that squirrel as long as the squirrel does what it's been designed to do.
Yeah.
And he said, we've obviously developed as an animal that can think ahead and to understand what is actually going on from a physical and biological sense. And so you should learn a lot, you know.
Yeah.
And so you should be alert and see what the problems are, become the expert on how to do it, form a team usually.
Yeah.
And then do something about it.
And do something productive. David McConville at Illuminati, one of the things you do is you try to take Bucky's theories and his notion of the world game out to the public, is to look at one of these ideas, and that is, where are the world's resources? How are they being used? And correlate those with where wars are fought.
Correct. I mean, there's an immense amount of visualization power, if you will, available to us at this point that are way beyond even what Bucky imagined in terms of being able to have a meaningful interface to different types of data. So you could, for instance, be looking at the globe looking at the planet Earth from outer space, and then have different bars or charts or anything come up displaying, you know, where military bases are, where there's conflict happening, where there are resources, where there's consumption. And it really helps to bring home the fact that we're living in this very interrelated dynamic spaceship. And, you know, and as you said, we're all astronauts.
Yeah.
And so it really helps people that wouldn't normally have perhaps such a comprehensive perspective on what all of this means really get it in an intuitive and visual sense, especially kids, because they've kind of grown up inside of these first-person computer graphic spaces, and to be able to infuse meaning into that, I think, is a very, very vital component of what this technology can be used for.
Did Bucky have a sense of where digital technology was going? Did he talk much about that during his life?
At the time when he was proposing World Game and another idea called a geoscope for being able to visualize different types of data sets on the Earth's surface, it was pretty remarkable considering how far out a lot of this gaming technology really was. I think he had an incredible sense of it, and a lot of what he proposed was so far ahead of its time that it was, you know, he was putting out proposals for like $6 million systems to be able to put it all together and bring in the supercomputers and do all these things that now you can pretty much do with a laptop and you know, some pretty simple technology. It's just that I think his vision was so strong that when people tap into that and they really start to understand where he was going with this, it's incredibly inspirational.
I'd like to hear you talk a little bit about any transformation that you may have seen in people who have been exposed to these kind of displays.
Actually, I was in Portugal a few weeks ago, and I was working with some Swedish software developers that didn't know anything about Buckminster Fuller, but they'd been working on a software program to be able to visualize all of NASA's data about the universe. So it's everything from the planet Earth, like I said, all the way to the background radiation and everything in between on 10 orders of magnitude all throughout the universe. When I started explaining to them Fuller's concept of the geoscope and of the World Game and of the importance of being able to visualize, not only visualize the information, but of being able to tell a compelling story with the information, they got so incredibly excited because it put a context around what they're doing. They had a lot of these ideas, but when they saw that there was a real movement afoot from people that had taken clues from what Bucky was doing to try to put meaning into a lot of this technology, they got very, very excited. And as a result, they're going to be coming over to New York and going to a conference later this month called Games for Change that the Buckminster Fuller Institute is co-sponsoring to talk about, you know, how video game developers can really start to become involved in this process of getting people to understand, you know, the components of the spaceship that we live on.
And talking about the skepticism, Jay Baldwin, getting back to some of your early contact, you know, Bucky says, or he writes, that industrialization's coordinated productivity can be employed directly by spontaneous cooperation of humanity without business profit motivation. In other words, there's plenty of energy out there. We can give it to each other, and there doesn't have to be a business component in here to tax it, meter it, and profit by it. When he says things like that, you know, did you find that people, that's when they turned their backs and said, you get the human nature argument. Humans have always been this way.
And he was well aware of that, but he also understood from working, it's really quite remarkable if you get a small team of people together and kind of agree beforehand to hang your egos on a hook at the door before you walk into the room and get to work, how much you can do. I have never sought work in my whole adult career, and I'm 72. I've worked only from project to project, and the projects have all been involved with, let's see if we can do this, because it's something that is going to be needed later, or we need it right now.
Bucky, go ahead.
And the money comes. It's amazing that when you're working on the right thing, the money comes towards you.
Well, Bucky has said that, in fact, most of humanity is engaged, 90% of us are engaged in things that don't produce wealth and don't produce energy.
Yes, and there's so much. It's sort of an amazing thing is that I have students I teach now and still, and students say, you know, it looks like nobody's working on the things that really need working on. And that sometimes you just can't believe that people don't work on these things. Like, it's, what is it, 30,000 people a day starve to death? Goodness.
Did you have a sense in working with Bucky that folks would come around, or did you think, well, I'll just do my little part, but I'm not sure anybody's ever going to embrace these ideas?
Well, I try to do my little part, and I spread the ideas as much as I can because I've always done part-time teaching on the side, and I find that students are excited by the idea that we can actually be a success on Earth. Bucky said that our duty as human beings is to make humans a success on Earth, and he said he was absolutely convinced that we could be. But as he got older, he was not at all convinced that we would be, because people are doing, as it's pretty clear these days, the absolute opposite of what they should be doing in many cases.
Let's take one more call. Megan is on the line from Pittsburgh. Hello, Megan.
Hi. Hi, can you hear me?
Oh, yeah. Go ahead.
Okay. I just have an anecdote, really. And the background is that I have llamas and donkeys, and the breeders from whom I bought them, they live in Person County, pretty rural part of North Carolina, have their entire, all of their animals, and indeed themselves, are housed in modified geodesic domes. And so they're, I think, between maybe 20 and 25 domes, ranging from lawnmower size and goat size all the way up to large enough for 5 to 10 llamas to be in. And we have a dome, and it's the most phenomenal structure, because when the snow comes, the snow falls off. When trees fall or when we have bad winds, the entire structure absorbs kind of equally any of the forces that are put onto it. And it's even more than the animals. I think it's more of a conversational piece than anything else when people come. And what's unfortunate is that the design for it that the breeder, that Marty and Ken St. Clair had to help us build ours, it's out, you can't find it anymore. It's, and I don't even know where they got theirs, but it's, you know, a many, many generation Xeroxed copy of something. And I'm surprised more people aren't looking into things like that, because it is such an efficient structure.
Let's get a response. Thanks, Megan.
Can I say something about that? I mean, a big idea that Bucky had, a contention that he had, was that good ideas and good design would actually be manifest in the physical universe in which we live. And so actually a couple of years before carbon-60 was discovered, which is the third form of carbon discovered in, I believe, 1982-83.
And that's what we call buckyballs, right?
That's what we call buckyballs. Yeah. It turns out that they're very small, you know, geodesic spheres. And so it really fits in remarkably well with this whole idea that life is a series of processes and patterns going from the micro to the macro, and it's really a matter of understanding and tapping into what those patterns are.
Well, I wish we had the 4 hours that Bucky might have taken to explain his life and accomplishments, but we don't. Out of time. David McConville, thank you very much.
Thank you.
David McConville is co-founder of Illuminati, a company in Asheville that designs immersive projection environments. Jay Baldwin is author of Bucky Works, Buckminster Fuller's Ideas for Today. And that's the state of things for today. Our show is produced by Corey Princell, Megan Davis, Robin Copley, Dave DeWitt, and Susan Davis. Thank you very much for listening. If you have a comment, you can drop us an email at sot@wunc.org. Support for the state of things comes from listeners who support North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. I'm Frank Stachow.